I've been asked to start out with a few words about Object Coal, and I'm sure some, you know, many of you will have heard about it and would want me to. Coal is the name of the discoverer, Charles Coal, at the Hale Observatories, which includes Palomar, and that's where he works. That's where the 200-inch telescope is, which was the largest in the world until very recently, and is still the largest in the Western Hemisphere. The biggest is now the Russian's 236-inch. And he is a very interesting person. He showed up there a few years ago, somehow managed to get a job on the staff, and he gives those of us who do not have PhDs great encouragement, because he in fact has nothing more than a bachelor's, but has already discovered something of the order of 80 supernovae, several comets, the 13th moon of Jupiter, Leda, and probably a 14th last year. That one is still not confirmed, because he discovered it at the very end of the period last year when you could observe Jupiter. It has been lost since. He was not able to observe it well enough to get a good orbit on it. It's a very, very faint object, so it's very easy to lose. But he is quite certain that it does exist, and in fact thinks there's a 50-50 chance he can recover it this year. So the reason I'm saying Object Coal is that that is the standard astronomical designation for a new body that's been discovered, and you're not quite sure of what its nature is, whether it's an asteroid or a comet, for example. In this case, it's quite clear that it's not a comet, but I just give that as an example. You name it Object plus the name of its discoverer, and then when they finally find out what it is, that gets taken away. So you see the discoverer has an incentive not to do any more work on it after the time it's found. It is not a tenth planet, as it has been widely described, and the reason that I say that is that it simply is not big enough to be a planet. Its size can be measured from its brightness only. You can't see a disk on it. It's simply a dot of light in our best telescopes. But the brightness gives you a hint. It gives you no more than a hint, because it depends on how reflective the object is. If it's white and you see it at a certain brightness, obviously it's a good deal smaller than if it were black and you see it at the same brightness. You know, then it'd have to be a lot larger, a lot more reflecting surface. And unfortunately, in the outer solar system, either extreme or anything in between is quite possible. If it could, it could very well be white. A number of objects out there are either made of or covered by snow of various sort: frozen water, frozen methane, frozen ammonia, maybe frozen carbon dioxide, mixtures thereof. Comets are that way. A number of the moons of the outer planets are that way. The rings of Saturn are that way, and so forth. On the other hand, there are a number of objects that are very, very black, blacker than any common rock on Earth, for example, blacker than coal or slate. And these are very interesting bodies. They are made of the same material as the class of meteorites called carbonaceous chondrites, which are of interest for a whole bunch of reasons. One, they are the most primitive material in the solar system, the least changed since the solar system formed 4.6 billion years ago. Another is that they are very rich in organic substances. Now, when I say that, don't get excited for the wrong reason. They were not formed by life processes, but we can show that they were formed by non-living processes. But they are the same class of chemicals, that is, complex carbon-based molecules of which living things are made, and it is entirely possible that the origin of life on Earth was from such chemicals that had been delivered to the surface of the Earth at some time after the formation of the Earth, and then the Earth went through a very, very hot stage, which might very well have destroyed any organics that it had at the time. It may have been reseeded by organics, by carbonaceous chondrites falling on it. It's a nice theory. Of course, you know, there's no way to prove it, because all the evidence would have been destroyed since. You may eventually be able to prove it by looking at other planets where the evidence has not been destroyed. The third reason they're of interest goes back to the space colonization lecture that I gave some time ago here, and that is that carbonaceous chondritic material is even better than lunar material for building large structures in space. You've got all the good things that you have in lunar materials. You can make oxygen, you have silicon, so you can make glass, you've got all kinds of metals. In addition to that, you have the things in carbonaceous chondrites that the moon is not rich in: water, these organics, and so you can synthesize petrochemicals, just all kinds of good things. So the latest wrinkle in space colonization is to find ourselves a very small carbonaceous chondritic asteroid, maybe 200 feet across, which is in an orbit such that it crosses the orbit of the Earth. Most asteroids are in the asteroid belt, which orbit the Sun between Mars and Jupiter, like so many thousands of little individual planets. But occasionally, such a body, large or small, gets perturbed out of the asteroid belt, Perturbed here is a technical term. It means that it is disturbed by the gravity of some planet, particularly Jupiter. If it makes a fairly close approach to Jupiter, its orbit gets changed in such a way that it can cross the orbit of the Earth. We had a spectacular example of that with a rather small object, probably a few inches or feet across, the week before this one, when one of them entered the Earth's atmosphere at the location where Michigan happened to be, and we had a spectacular meteor across the state, which was bright enough to be visible in daylight. And then the following week, along comes Object Cole. So all in all, it's been quite interesting period astronomically. Well, this carbonaceous chondritic material is very common in the outer solar system. The moons of Mars are both made of it. Most of the asteroids in the main belt turn out to be made of it, especially those in the outer portion of the belt. A number of the moons of the outer planets are probably made of it. The rings of Uranus, discovered this past March, are probably made of it. They appear to be very, very black. No one's been able to photograph them, and you can put upper limits on how bright they could be, how reflective they could be, and that ends up with something so black that the only reasonable composition is carbonaceous chondritic. Okay, so what I'm trying to tell you, getting back to Object Cole, is that you don't know what the stuff is made of, what the thing is made of, and it could be anything from really white to really black, and the range of possible diameters is 100 miles if it's white, up to 400 miles across if it's black, and that is not a planet. You cannot call something like that a planet. I would call an object of that size an asteroid. The discoverer, Charles Cole, does not like to call it an asteroid. I phoned him the day after the story broke, and it was very hard to get through to him because every other newsman in the country had the same idea. And by the time I got him, I said, "How many people have phoned you today?" And he said, "I don't know, but it doesn't." So nevertheless, he was very kind about answering questions, and I suppose it was sort of a relief to talk to somebody that could throw around terms like carbonaceous chondritic and not have to have them explained. So I asked him all the technical questions. He said he doesn't like to call it an asteroid because it's not in the asteroid belt. Well, okay, fine, but there are a number of bodies that are not in the asteroid belt that are still called asteroids. For example, the Trojan asteroids, which are named for heroes in the Trojan War, which are entirely in the orbit of Jupiter, 60 degrees ahead of Jupiter and 60 degrees behind Jupiter. And again, those of you that know about the space colonization idea will understand that those are stable positions. There are a number of bodies, hundreds of bodies in those positions in Jupiter's orbit, and they're all called asteroids just as well. So the way I would describe the significance of this discovery is that in many ways it is more interesting than a tenth planet would be, because after all, we've already got a whole bunch of planets. You know, another one would be exciting, but it would be just one more of a class of bodies we already know about. This time it is something brand new. It is something literally unprecedented. It is the only known case of an asteroid which is large, which is hundreds of miles across. Most of them are a good deal smaller than that. Most of the ones that are known are maybe a quarter mile across, and that's just because our telescopes can't photograph them when they're much fainter than that. So the majority of them are undoubtedly a great deal smaller than that. Indeed, there is no distinction between an asteroid and a meteoroid except size. You know, they're undoubtedly a continuous size spectrum. This is the only large asteroid that is known outside the asteroid belt. And it is entirely possible, now here comes pure speculation, but it's entirely possible that this could be just the first object discovered in a whole new asteroid belt lying between the orbits of Saturn and Uranus. I asked Cole about that possibility, and he said, yes, in the first place, the telescope that I'm using, which is the 48-inch Schmidt telescope on Mount Palomar, not the 200-inch, because this telescope can go almost as faint as the 200-inch can, and it has a very, very much wider field. So when you're searching for objects whose locations you don't know anything about, that's the kind of telescope that you want to use. And indeed, there are only four such telescopes on Earth. The other three happen not to be being used for such a search program, because there are a lot of other things you can do with them well also. And Cole is the only one who is using the 48-inch Schmidt for this purpose. And so what that comes down to is that Cole is probably the only person on Earth who could have made this discovery, at least at this particular moment in history, which is kind of neat. I mean, it had to be called Object Cole. There's no other way. So he said that telescope can go down considerably fainter than this object is. It's already 60 times fainter than Pluto, this thing he discovered, but you can go about 40 or 50 times fainter than that. And in addition, he has searched only one-third of the ecliptic. That is the circle in the sky where, for various reasons that I don't have time to explain, you expect most solar system objects to be, unless they're really unusual, and this particular one is in fact found near the ecliptic. So it's entirely possible that there could be more of them of the same size, and that there could be more of them that are even smaller. Or, of course, it may be that this one is all by itself out there, in which case we're going to have to figure out why it is there, what's so special about it. And obvious possibilities occur, an escape satellite of one of the outer planets, for example, you know, other things like that. On the other hand, it's entirely possible, if there is an asteroid belt there, that both Saturn and Uranus picked up their satellites by capture from that asteroid belt, you see. So either way, this is going to be a major hint as to the early history of this particular part of the solar system, and once again, it shows how very, very little we know about the outer regions of the solar system. I like to say in planetarium shows, the planet Uranus is so little known that most people don't even pronounce it correctly. And this is true. We're finding out all kinds of things about Uranus particularly that we just didn't know, and the rings are the most spectacular example, but there are a bunch of others in recent years as well. The orbit of this body is not at all well known, and the news reports have said that it orbits the Sun between Saturn and Uranus. That is more likely to be true than any other statement, but it's not certain yet. The one thing you can say is it's been photographed so far on only 6 nights, and 2 of those were in fact accidental pictures that were taken of it several nights before it was discovered, and when the discovery was announced, you know, the people that had taken these pictures for other reasons went back, looked through their pictures, and discovered that they had 2 more images of it, and of course they didn't know it was there. It just looks like one more star out of thousands on the plate. You won't see something like that unless you're actually looking for it. The 6 observations are simply not enough to define its orbit very well. And I also talked to Brian Marsden, who is the man that does the orbit calculations on this kind of thing at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory. He said that he can satisfy the observations with orbits ranging from an essentially perfect circle, which is centered on the Sun and is about 3 astronomical units closer to the Sun than Uranus. An astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the Sun, 93 million miles. It's a convenient yardstick to use in outer solar system. And to give you the way the yardstick fills in, Jupiter is about 5 astronomical units from the Sun, Saturn is 10, Uranus is 20. So we're talking about something somewhere around 16, 17 astronomical units from the Sun, in between Saturn and Uranus, but closer to Uranus. But he can fit the observations with orbits ranging all the way from a circle like that up to a parabola in which the closest approach to the Sun is about where we see it now, and the far end is at infinity. In other words, if you believe that the orbit was parabolic, it would be something that was visiting us from interstellar space. He doesn't like the idea of anything other than the circular orbit, because he points out that if you have an orbit which crosses the orbit of Uranus or Neptune, and those are, well, here, I've got this perfectly good overhead projector. Let's draw it for you. This is the orbit of Uranus, and say here's the orbit of Neptune, and here is the Sun. There is Uranus, there is Neptune. Our object at the moment is right there, almost exactly opposite Uranus in the sky at the moment. And I pricked up my ears when I heard that, because that's a stable place too. It's one of the Lagrangian points, libration points, whatever you want to call them. But the Lagrangian point would be there, see, on the orbit of Uranus. And this is not there, it's inside. The 2 stable, I'm messing this up, this is Uranus here. Our object is here, inside the orbit of Uranus, not up there. If it had an object, if it had an orbit which crosses the orbit of Uranus and maybe even of Neptune, something like that, that would not be stable over any long period of time. And so you'd be faced with the problem of how it managed to get into such an orbit. That's not completely ridiculous. It could happen to be in an unstable orbit at the moment that later on it was going to get perturbed out of. But Marsden, just for that reason, prefers a more nearly circular orbit. I did not, unfortunately, think to ask him what would happen if it literally was a parabolic orbit, one that would look like this, like a big U with the 2 ends going out to infinity, essentially, which means somewhere out in interstellar space. I don't think that's at all ridiculous, because there are a number of theories of the origin of stars and planets which imply that for every star that is formed, There are, well, to pick a number from one particular theory, Jack Hills, who was at the University of Michigan at the time this was propounded, and in fact is now coming to Michigan State, and is a very, very brilliant theorist of the origin of the solar system, among many other things. Jack told me once that, according to his version of the origin of the solar system, there would be about 10 times as many sunless planets formed as objects that are bright enough, that are big enough to become actual stars. And so these things would be floating around out there, absolutely unobservable, because they'd be so faint if they were in the spaces between the stars. And it's not at all ridiculous, I don't think, that one of them could happen to be visiting the solar system for this particular series of decades that we happen to be living in. You'd expect it to be picked up when it was somewhere in the region near its closest approach to the sun, where it would be brightest. So that would still be a rather remarkable coincidence, but by no means so impossible as to be out of the question. We're just going to have to wait and see. I'm sure that Marsden is right, and the most likely orbit is something like this. If that's true, then the period of the object, the length of time that it takes to go around the sun, would be something of the order of 50 to 60 years. Compare Uranus, which takes 84 years to go around, and Saturn, the next planet in, which takes 29. And so that's an update on Object Cole. It is not a tenth planet. It should not be called that. No matter how you want to define this, no matter whether you want to call this an asteroid or dream up some new word for it, like mini-planet, which apparently is being thrown around by Cole and some of his colleagues out there, it is not a planet. And if you're going to start calling something this big a planet, there are a number of asteroids in the main belt, for example, Ceres and Vesta, which are bigger than it is and which you would have to call planets as well. And so this wouldn't be the 10th planet, it would be the 14th or thereabouts. That's ridiculous, you just don't use that terminology that way. So much for that. Okay, let's get on to relativity, which is what I came to talk about. And I don't know if you are all aware that this is a relativity lecture, but it is. I called it Why You Can't Go Faster Than Light with Malice Aforethought. I want to warn you about several things. First of all, like all the lectures that I give, this is intended to be just a straightforward, popular-level lecture for people with little or no previous acquaintance with the subject. If there happen to be any physics types here who are expecting some deep, profound, new theoretical revelation of something that I've discovered, that's not what the lecture is about, you know. I am not a theorist in this field. I'm not a specialist in the field. I just wanted to try to tell people who weren't familiar with physics some things about these subjects. Secondly, somebody in the back of the room is just sitting there waiting for the first chance to ask me if I haven't heard about tachyons. And the answer is I have heard about tachyons, and for those that haven't, I'll tell you about them a bit later on. But I chose this title very carefully, as Lee emphasized when he read it to you. The title is not Why Everything Can't Go Faster Than Light, but Why You Can't, if tachyons exist. And so far, they are a theoretical entity. Maybe they really do exist, maybe they don't. But whether they exist or not, the one thing we can be certain of is you aren't made of them, and therefore you can't go faster than light, whether tachyons can or not. And the third thing that I should point out is that I picked that title rather than relativity simply because people have been trained to be frightened by the word relativity, and you shouldn't be. There are these stories floating around about how relativity is so fantastically difficult that only 12 people in the world can understand it, all this kind of garbage. And that is just sheer nonsense. That has never been true, unless there happened to be some evening when Einstein hadn't published it yet and had 11 of his friends over for a cocktail party and, you know, told him about it before publication. There, anyone of normal intelligence or greater can understand the conclusions of relativity. They are strange. They're outside your everyday experience. But so are many other things which you never feel incapable of understanding. For example, a battle between a sperm whale and a giant squid, you know, is something that you've never seen, probably never will, but nevertheless you can understand it once it's explained to you. Before you know about all the details, they may seem strange. Same thing is true with relativity. Even anybody of normal intelligence can understand the conclusions of relativity if you don't always insist on having every last one proved to you. To prove it would require some mathematics. Now, this is a non-mathematical lecture, but in fact, if I were to give a mathematical version of it and really go through all the proofs, in a half of relativity, even that is not terribly difficult. And if you'd like to follow this up, there are places where you can be introduced to the mathematics of half of relativity and go through it and really see how all these things come out. You see, the theory of relativity, so-called, although theory is misleading here, it's a theory in the sense that everything in science is hypothetical, you're never absolutely certain of anything, but at least the half of relativity I'm going to talk about tonight, the part called special relativity, has been checked out 6 ways from Sunday, and it has been tested as thoroughly as anything in all of science, and found out to be exactly as Einstein said that it would be. So it's not a theory in the sense that it's uncertain and speculative and nobody really believes it yet. Maybe it was that way at one time it was published, but certainly no longer. But the theory of relativity is divided into 2 sections. There is the special theory of relativity and the general theory of relativity. And although their philosophical and scientific mathematical underpinnings have a great deal in common, their conclusions are virtually decoupled from one another. Special relativity has to do with phenomena that happen when you get up to speeds that are close to that of light. And the speed of light is 186,282.3960 miles per second. I will round that off in the future to 186,000. The general theory of relativity is our best existing description of gravity. And, you know, that gravity seems to have nothing much to do with the speed of light. And in fact, as far as the conclusions go, it doesn't. It's when you get down into the deep underpinnings that it really does. Well, as far as the mathematical backgrounds of these two go, special relativity uses very simple math. There is nothing in it worse than high school algebra. Now, I realize there are those of you to whom high school algebra is quite enough, but believe me, there are branches of mathematics that are very much worse, and it is only when you get into the general theory of relativity that you have to use those. General relativity uses a great deal of something called tensor calculus, and that is really hairy. That doesn't mean that you can't understand it. It means it would take a great deal of study before you did so. And so the number of people who understand, in the sense of being able to derive the conclusions of general relativity, is not a dozen, but I'm sure tens of thousands all around the earth. And the only reason it's not greater is that it's a specialized subject, and most people who, you know, could understand it in principle happen to be in other fields. The whole thing about a dozen is just sheer nonsense. What I'm going to talk about tonight is special relativity only. If you would like more information about both special and general, there are a number of excellent books on the subject which have been written, ironically enough, clearly and directly and intended for people with no background, intended for popular consumption, just because relativity got the reputation of being something very difficult to understand, and therefore it was a challenge to science popularizers, and so there are not one but several good books on it. Of those, I think the best and the most current, there's been a good deal of theoretical work on general relativity in the last few years, getting into things like black holes and so forth, and the older books won't have that, although they're fine as far as they go. You know, they just don't tell you as much as this new one would. But I think the best one is by Martin Gardner, who is the mathematical games editor of Scientific American, and he spells his name G-A-R-D-N-E-R, and his book is called The Relativity Explosion, in order to express the idea that it does cover these new implications of the subject, which some of the older ones do not. It is out in paperback. I'm sure it's for sale in a number of the textbook stores around campus, and if you would like to go further than I do tonight, this is the first book that I'd recommend. Einstein himself has also written a paperback on relativity, which is not quite as easy to understand as Gardner's, takes you a little bit further, goes into a little bit of the math, and so I recommend reading that second. There is also a book by Lincoln Barnett, one by Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, a very good one, The ABC of Relativity. And on top of these, I would recommend a work of fiction, if any of you are into science fiction, or even if you're not, because very often you can get a feeling for what these things are like, you know, if you were there, from fiction, that is more vivid than you can get from nonfiction. There is a subgenre of science fiction which is called hard science fiction, and that is a sorry commentary on the state of science fiction, because hard science fiction is defined as science fiction in which the science is accurate. It is felt necessary to define a subgenre, since that's a fairly rare thing. One of its finest practitioners is Poul Anderson, and he has written a novel, which I think you will enjoy as a novel, but will also introduce you quite painlessly to some of the stranger conclusions of general relativity, and it is called Tau Zero, for reasons that have to do with the subject. So I'd recommend these two books for anybody that wants to go on further, one nonfiction, one fiction. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about the special theory of relativity, minus the math, although the math is not all that difficult, and that has to do with things that happen as you get to speeds up near the speed of light, which you never have in all of your life, and that is the reason that people sometimes complain that the conclusions of relativity are, quote, impossible to understand. All they mean is that they seem to violate common sense and that they are things that people have never experienced in everyday life. Well, okay, fine. The reason for that is that the speeds that we experience in everyday life, and by everyday life I include even cases in astronomy up until the astronomy that we began to have around about 1920, 1930, simply do not involve speeds that are anything like close to that of light. The fastest you personally have ever gone and are going right now is a speed of 18.5 miles per second. That is the speed at which the Earth is carrying you as it moves in its orbit around the Sun. And that speed is 1/10,000th of the speed of light. Astrophysical cases within our galaxy give you speeds up to several thousand miles per second, and that is still only a tiny fraction of the speed of light. And so you simply do not see these effects. If the speed of light were 60 miles an hour, then you would see them all the time in everyday life. You would be used to the fact that as a kid got on a bicycle and started riding it down the street, he would get shorter in the direction of his motion, and it would not seem strange to you that in fact that sort of thing happens as you get near the speed of light. But since the speed of light is not something you encounter in everyday life, you're not used to it. So the only thing that's difficult about understanding the conclusions of relativity is that you have to accept to a certain extent that yes, these things really have been observed by people who have observed phenomena at near the speed of light, and indeed they have, and I will try to make that believable to you by giving you examples as we go along. Let me talk about two of the three things that happen as the speed of light increases, and leave the third for a little bit later on. The third, I think, is the clearest example, the clearest explanation of the what seems, I think, to most people to be the strangest of the relativistic phenomena, and therefore the one that I picked for my title, and that is the fact that there exists a cosmic speed limit, that there is a speed faster than which you simply cannot go. And the way that people are, the reason people are always bothered about this, the way they always think about it, is suppose you have a rocket ship, and you know that if you press a particular button, it will fire the rocket at such a thrust and for such a duration that it will increase your speed from 0% of the speed of light to 1/10th the speed of light. Okay? But suppose you have such a rocket ship. Of course, we haven't built one yet that can do that, but, you know, pretend that we can. Obviously, there's nothing physically impossible about that. Well, the way that people always express their puzzlement about this cosmic speed limit is to say, suppose we take that rocket ship up to the point where it's moving at 9/10 the speed of light, and then we fire the button again. Surely our speed will again increase by an amount equal to 1/10 the speed of light, and we will go up from 0.9 the speed of light to the speed of light. Or let's do it even better. Suppose we get it up to 0.95 the speed of light, and then press that button, we ought to go up to 1.05 times the speed of light, right? And if not, why not? Okay, that is what I'm going to try to tell you, but I want to do that a little bit later on and tell you about the other two things first. They're a little bit easier to understand, I think. The first thing that happens as... No, I'm sorry, all three of them happen simultaneously. The first thing that I want to tell you about that happens as you get into speeds that are close to that of light is that your length in the direction of your motion only, that dimension, decreases. And this is not something that you would feel because all length inside, for example, the rocket ship that you are in, which is traveling at some high speed compared to the speed of light, decrease uniformly. And so you take a yardstick and you hold it up and measure your particular dimension along the direction of motion, and you find it's still exactly what it always was. But I'm looking through the porthole from outside as you move past me at 9/10 the speed of light, and I say, well, yeah, of course you think that way because your yardstick has shrunk, you see, and all lengths inside the rocket ship that are moving past me at that speed, as I look at them, all of these lengths have decreased by exactly the same proportion. So you don't feel squashed. Nothing is crushing you. No, the sides of the rocket ship are not moving in on you as far as you can see. Everything, the very atoms that you are made of, are shrinking by exactly the same proportion, and they are doing so only along the direction parallel to your direction of motion. Let's turn on the overhead projector again and illustrate what I mean. What I'm saying is that if this is the rocket ship as I see it when it is moving, when it is not moving with respect to me, and it looks something like that, and there are you. I do not pretend to be a very accomplished artist, but that will get the idea across. This dimension, you're going to move in this direction, right? So this is when your velocity equals zero. When your velocity equals 0.9 the speed of light, which is always indicated as c, then this dimension is still the same. The dimension perpendicular to your velocity is still the same, but everything in the direction of motion has been squashed, and so the widths are all the same, but the lengths have all decreased, and in particular, your own body. If your head started out as a circle, the way I drew it up there at the top, that circle would become squashed until it would look something like an ellipse. Now, mind you, you don't feel that, because here you are holding a yardstick, and here you are again holding a yardstick in the moving rocket ship, and in both cases, the yardstick is exactly the distance between the ends of your hands, the way I've drawn it, but the yardstick has shrunk, and the length of your arms have shrunk, and so you don't notice any difference. As far as you can tell, everything is still normal. Before I go any further, I have got to fill in something that I deliberately left out, and that is that I just cheerfully assumed that you are moving and I am holding still. And we have to be very careful about how we define what we mean by that kind of statement. There is no such thing as absolute velocity. As far as you in the rocket ship are concerned, you are stationary, and I, together with the rest of the universe, am moving past you in the opposite direction at 9/10 the speed of light. That is what relativity is all about. There is no such thing as absolute motion. There is only relative motion of one object relative to another. And it is the consequences of that fact that relativity explores, and that is why it is called relativity. Newton specifically denied what I have just said. He said that there is such a thing as motion with respect to absolute space, because he realized there were all sorts of problems if you assumed otherwise. And it's taken us 2 centuries after Newton to realize that, in fact, you know, it's not that he didn't know the problem. He did know it. He understood it very thoroughly. And he came to the conclusion that things would open up a real can of worms if you could not define absolute motion, and so took the easy way out and defined it. But you cannot define it. Let me illustrate what I mean, and you'll see, see a little bit more clearly about what I mean by absolute. How fast are you moving at this moment? Well, if it hadn't been asked in this context, you probably would have answered the question the way, you know, a person normally would. I'm not moving at all. I'm just sitting here in the chair. But an astronomer can tell you, no, you are moving at this latitude about 750 miles an hour due east because of the rotation of the Earth. The Earth is carrying you and the chair and the room and the air and everything else that you see, including my humble self, with it at a speed of 18.5 miles per second as it moves around the sun. The sun is moving at a speed relative to the average of the nearby stars of about 12 miles per second in the general direction of the constellation Hercules. All of the stars that are near the sun, including the sun, are moving as a group around the center of the galaxy at about 250 miles a second. The center of the galaxy is revolving around the center of the cluster of galaxies that we are a member of, which is located somewhere between ourselves and the Andromeda Galaxy. We do not know that speed, but we know that there is such a motion. The entire cluster is moving around the center of our supercluster of galaxies, which is in the direction of the constellation Virgo, 50 million light years away, at a speed that, again, we do not know, but we know the motion exists, and so on and so forth. So, how fast are you moving? Well, the answer to that question depends on the answer to the question, moving with respect to what? An observer on the sun considers your motion as 18.5 miles per second. An observer on some nearby star considers your motion as some complex combination of that 18.5 miles per second in one direction plus the motion of the sun in some different direction. You consider your motion to be zero. All of those answers are equally valid. And if you try to answer the question, okay, how fast am I moving relative to a point in space which is stationary, you find that there is no way to define the term point in space which is stationary, and therefore you cannot answer the question. How do you measure your motion with respect to a point in empty space? There is nothing there, by definition. Space is empty. It is not a thing. There is not something to it. You say, well, all right, I will take a marker, this bright red tennis ball, and I will place it at that point in space and order it to stay there, and then I will move past it. But of course you can't do that. You can't order it to stay there. It's going to start moving by a motion determined by the gravitational fields of all the nearby objects, and so you will indeed be able to measure your motion relative to the tennis ball, but that will be the motion relative to a material object, not to a point in space. There is no way to mark a point in absolute space, therefore there is no way to measure your velocity relative to a point in absolute space. So all you can do is talk about relative velocities. And so let me rephrase what I said about the person in the rocket ship a little bit more carefully. If you are in the rocket ship and you are moving past me at a speed which I measure correctly as 9/10 the speed of light, then as I measure distances inside the rocket ship, for example, the length of the rocket ship, the diameter of your head, whatever I might want to measure, if I measure them in the direction perpendicular to the direction of that relative motion, I get exactly the same answer as if you were stationary with respect to me. But if I measure distances parallel to the direction of motion, I find that they have been shortened. How much have they been shortened? Depends on how fast you're going. For the specific number that I gave, 9/10 the speed of light, the distances that I would measure would be 44% as great as the distances that I measured when you were not moving past me. I want to make absolutely certain that you understand that I am not talking about some sort of optical illusion here. I am not talking about something that is due to the fact that I am looking at light and light itself takes time to travel, which is comparable to the time that it takes you to travel and so forth. Let's take an example that gets rid of all of those things. I take a yardstick which is not moving with respect to me. I hold it up in the air at a position such that your rocket ship will move just past it, and at the exact moment that your rocket ship moves past that yardstick of mine, which is not moving with respect to me, I take a snapshot of it, an instantaneous snapshot, you know, 10 trillionth of a second exposure, using some very intense light source so that I can do that. And then I measure distances very carefully and accurately. This is not something stupid like there are measurement errors. We'll assume infinitely perfect measurement in all discussions in this lecture. Nevertheless, I discover that everything is only 44% as long as it was when you were holding still with respect to me. Why don't you notice this in everyday life? Because the effect is very, very small for speeds that are very small compared to that of light. And furthermore, it's not linear. It's not as though if you're going at twice the speed, you got twice the effect. The amount of all of these effects, not just the length one, but all of them, is such that if you graph the amount of the effect, like so, versus the speed, like so, and here is 0% the speed of light, and there is 100% the speed of light, and this is the magnitude of the effect up here, it's very, very small, even when you get up to 30-40% the speed of light, and then it really begins to take off, and all the effects become very, 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 very large as you get through those last few decimal places right up towards 100%. And so if you are moving at half the speed of light, your length is still a good 87% of what it was when you were holding still. If you are moving at 0.9 the speed of light, as I mentioned, it's down to 0.44, so it's a little bit less than half. If you're moving at 0.99 the speed of light, your length shrinks to only 14% of what it was when you were holding still. If you're moving at 0.999 the speed of light, why don't I write down these numbers? Here's your speed, and I'll use the standard symbol beta to mean your speed expressed not in miles per second or kilometers per hour or furlongs per fortnight or some other arbitrary human designation, but your speed expressed as a fraction of the speed of light. Okay? So if your speed is zero, you're not moving with respect to me. If your beta is zero, if your beta is 0.5, you're moving at half the speed of light with respect to me, all right? If your beta is 1.0, you're moving at the speed of light with respect to me, and so forth. Okay, if beta is 0.5, then your length, expressed again as a fraction of your original length, is, another H in there, never mind, is 87%. If you're moving at 0.9 the speed of light, it is down to 44%. 0.99 the speed of light, it is 14%. 0.999 the speed of light, it is 4.5% the original. And 0.9999, we'll call that four nines, is 1.5%, 1.4% actually. Five nines the speed of light, 0.99999 the speed of light, it is 0.0045, or about half of 1% of what it was originally. And to jump right to the end of the table that I've been able to calculate, this is as far as my calculator will go, nine nines the speed of light. You don't expect me to actually do physical work here, do you? The calculator can't do it, I'm not going to do it. At 0.999999999 the speed of light, your length is only 0.00045 what it was originally, which is to say, if the rocket ship was 1 mile long, it has shrunk to be 2.8 inches in length, while its width is still the same. And so what it looks like is a disk moving along through space. If you could reach the speed of light, which you cannot, and that's the whole point of this lecture, but if you could, I think you can see that your length is shrinking in the direction such that as you approach the speed of light, your length is approaching zero. And so presumably at the speed of light, you would simply be an infinitesimally thin wave front moving along through space, which perhaps is suggestive of the fact that you cannot do it, but there are clearer proofs than that. I want you to understand, this is not just some sort of apparent shrinkage. It is quite genuine, it is quite real. It's called the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction, after the two physicists who came up with the formula for it before the theory of relativity was published by Einstein. And in fact, the reason that Einstein published it was to try to explain, among other things, the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction, which had already been observed. I want you to understand, this is real, it is there. Historically, the way it was first observed was in one of the most crucial experiments ever performed in the history of physics, the Michelson-Morley experiment, just after the turn of this century, which was named for the physicist Michelson, one of the great figures in physics, American physics, especially in the early part of this century, first American ever to win a Nobel Prize for science, and Morley, who was basically the guy who built the experiment, has never been heard of before or since. The Michelson-Morley experiment is described in great detail in all of the relativity books. To me, it seems confusing to go through all the details of how the experiment was run, because then what you do is get into a lot of hardware. And so what I'm going to do is simply tell you the bottom line of the Michelson-Morley experiment. Effectively, they discovered the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction without realizing it by building a device that was so sensitive that it could detect even the very, very, very tiny effect which is due to the Earth's orbital motion around the Sun. The Earth's orbital motion around the Sun is, as I mentioned, a mere 0.0001, the speed of light, and there your length is 0.9999995 what it was originally. But this device was so sensitive that they could detect that very, very slight shrinkage, and as you can imagine, it got them very, very surprised. Now, that's not literally what they did, and if you read about the Michelson-Morley experiment, that's not the way the results are always expressed. But it is logically equivalent to what they did, and so I'm going to tell you that that basically is what the Michelson-Morley experiment discovered. The same thing presumably happens at smaller speeds. Of course, you can't verify that because the effect is so tiny. But if you want to apply the same equation, I'll give you the equation a little later on just so you can see what it looks like. If you're not mathematically inclined, don't worry, it's not going to hurt. Won't take a very large part of the lecture. But the same equation could be applied to any speed if you like. And theoretically, a car that is going at 55 miles an hour is shorter, as measured by an observer on the side of the road now, not as measured by an observer in the car, is shorter by about the diameter of a neutron than the same car was when it was stationary with respect to the observer by the side of the road. And I think you begin to see why it is that you're not used to this kind of thing in everyday life. And so now I'll go back to my original example. If you had a speed of light at 60 miles an hour, and a kid got on a bicycle and went off down the street at 15 miles an hour, which is a quarter of the speed of light, you would actually notice a slight shrinkage of the kid and the bicycle, and you would be used to it, and you would expect it, and you wouldn't be bothered by it. The only reason you may be bothered by it is that you're simply not used to these very high speeds. You are now ready for the first limerick. There are a number of famous limericks associated with relativity, and there is the most famous of all, which we'll get to in a moment. This one is much less known, but in fact much more accurate, because the most famous one does not describe what would actually happen. This one does, and it goes as follows. There was a young fencer named Fisk, whose speed was exceedingly brisk. So rapid his action, Fitzgerald contraction reduced his épée to a disc. And that's exactly what would happen if his action were indeed as rapid as it is stated here. Of course, there would be a little problem, such as air friction vaporizing his arm if he were moving at a speed, anything like that of light. We ignore these things for the sake of art. The second of the three effects that I want to tell you about that happen as you get up near the speed of light is in some ways even harder to believe because it involves something that is much more slippery than length, and that is time. But it really does happen, and again, it's really been observed, and I'll give you examples of that. Time intervals, as measured, and I want to emphasize, as measured correctly, we're not just saying there's something weird that happens to the instruments when you get up to high speeds, as measured correctly by properly functioning instruments, time intervals of phenomena happening on a body which is moving with respect to you, you consider yourself a stationary observer, turn out to be different than those time intervals would be as measured correctly by you on an object that is not moving. And the way the difference goes is time appears to slow down on a moving object. So that if you have a clock which is known from long observation and careful construction to tick exactly once per second or flash a light exactly once per second or anything that you want it to do, and you put it on the rocket ship and the rocket ship goes by you at, let's say, 9/10 the speed of light, it will tick or flash the light or whatever it does not once every second but once every 2.25 seconds. And if it is moving past you at 0.9999 the speed of light, it will tick every 71 seconds. If it is moving past you at 9/9 the speed of light, 0.9999999999, it will tick every 22,361 seconds, and that is about a quarter of a day. Or to put it another year, if it ticked every 23 and a half minutes and it moved past you at 0.99 the speed of light, it ticked every 23 and a half minutes when it wasn't moving with respect to you, it will now tick once per year. And again, this is not an apparent effect. It is not something that, for some reason, affects the instruments that measure time. It is an actual slowing down of time itself, because it affects uniformly any process which happens as a function of time. Any kind of clock that you care to devise, radioactive decay, human aging processes, etc., ad infinitum. That means that if you could get into a rocket ship and travel from here to the nearest star, which is Alpha Centauri, 26 trillion miles away, so far away that it takes light traveling at 186,000 miles a second, which, by the way, is 7 times around the equator of the Earth in 1 second, if you could bend the light beam, or from here to the moon and back in 2.5 seconds. If you could get in that rocket ship and travel at a speed very close to that of light, you could go to Alpha Centauri and back. Alpha Centauri is so far away that it takes that beam of light 4 1/3 years to get there, or it takes the beam of light 4 1/3 years to get to us from Alpha Centauri. You would travel to it and back in a length of time which to you would seem like a day, a second, a billionth of a second, depending on exactly how close to the speed of light you got. And again, the effect is very, very small at speeds that are slow compared to light. It is not terribly great even when you get up to half the speed of light. And as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, it really mounts up. And as you approach the speed of light, it approaches an infinite stretching of time. So that time would seem, on a body moving at the speed of light, if such a thing were possible, to stop, which again is perhaps suggestive of the fact that it cannot be done. It depends on exactly how fast you're going, how much time slows down. Now, the people who stayed behind on Earth have not been traveling at that speed relative to the Earth, obviously. And so you get in your rocket ship and you go from here to Alpha Centauri, and let's suppose you don't stay there any time, you turn around and come right back. And let's suppose you did this at such a speed that it took only 1 second in your time for the entire trip. And this is really true. You had all these stopwatches along and they all measured exactly 1 second. You had radioactive material and it decayed only by the amount that it would in 1 second. Your own body processes changed only by the amount that they would in 1 second, and so you get back and you're not at all hungry and you don't need a bath and you're not sleepy and all the other things that would not have changed very much in 1 second will not have changed for you. But you get back and you discover that on Earth, twice 4.5 years or 9 years have gone by. All of your friends are 9 years older. 2 presidential elections have come and gone. Everything that should have happened in 9 years has happened, including the decay of radioactive elements and the aging processes of the people that stayed behind, and so on and so forth. It is a very real and very definite effect. And it's been observed. This is not just theoretical. It has been observed even at the relatively slow speeds that you can achieve in an airplane by taking the most accurate clocks that we have, atomic clocks, which are accurate to something of the order of a second in several million years. And so they are accurate enough that even very tiny discrepancies will show up. Putting one of them in a commercial airliner and simply flying the thing around the Earth as part of somebody's baggage, and then getting off and comparing it with a similar atomic clock that had been left behind and not moved, and the atomic clock that had moved with respect to the other one really had slowed down by exactly the amount that Einstein's formula said. That's a very tiny amount, so I'll give you another one that's perhaps more impressive. There are things called cosmic rays, which bombard the upper atmosphere of the Earth. They come from somewhere out in space. Exactly where and exactly how they get to have the properties they do, we don't know. Indeed, it's one of the big unsolved problems in astrophysics and has been for more than half a century. Suffice it to say, though, that they do exist. They are fragments of atoms, that is, nuclei of atoms from which the electrons have been stripped away. Most of them are single protons, because that's the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, and most of the matter in the universe is hydrogen. somehow they have had their electrons stripped off, and they have been accelerated to speeds that are very, very, very close to that of light. So close, in fact, that the most energetic cosmic rays, the fastest moving ones, could cross our entire galaxy in a time interval which, as seen by an observer measuring, moving on the cosmic ray particle, would be of the order of 5 minutes. Our galaxy is 100,000 light years across, and a light year is 6 trillion miles. So they are moving very, very fast indeed. How are they able to do this? Well, they're moving at essentially the speed of light, and because of the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction, the observer on the cosmic ray thinks of himself as being stationary, and the galaxy is moving past him at a speed very close to that of light. The Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction has shrunk the galaxy so that it is only 5 light minutes across. Therefore, traveling at about the speed of light, you can cross it in about 5 minutes. It's as simple as that. Cosmic rays come down, and they hit the upper atmosphere of the Earth, and about 60 miles above your head, they encounter air which is dense enough that they are almost certain at that height or above to have smashed into an air molecule and broken that air molecule apart, broken the nuclei of the atoms that it's made of apart, to be precise. Among the fragments that are produced in such an energetic collision are subatomic particles which are called mesons. There are many different kinds of mesons. I'm talking about one particular type here. And that type is well known from laboratory experiments done off the surface of the Earth, of course, to be incapable of living for more than a very tiny fraction of a second, something of the order of a few billionths of a second. And after that length of time, the meson splits spontaneously into other particles which are more stable. So we know the length of life of these mesons. They are knocked out of the nuclei of the atoms that are hit by the cosmic ray particle so violently that the mesons themselves are traveling practically at the speed of light. We know how high up in the atmosphere they are created, and we know how fast they're going, and therefore it's easy to calculate how far they can travel during the period of time that they will live before they break into their daughter particles. And that period of time is grossly insufficient for the mesons to travel from the top of the atmosphere to the bottom of the atmosphere. Therefore, we should not see any of the mesons here at the surface of the Earth with our cosmic ray detectors. We should see the daughter particles. The fact of the matter is, we see the mesons in quite large numbers. The reason is that a billionth of a second, as measured in the laboratory on the Earth, where the meson is not moving at a very high speed relative to the observer, is not the same as a billionth of a second measured in the time frame of a moving meson, which is traveling at almost the speed of light as it goes through the atmosphere. The time dilation effect, which is the name for this one, it's not named for some people, it's just called time dilation, is great enough on these mesons, which are moving at speeds very close to that of light, to stretch out from our point of view that billionth of a second into a much longer time, a time that is long enough that in the meson's time frame of a billionth of a second, it is traveling down from the top of the atmosphere to the bottom. And so we see them. So you see, time dilation really does happen. Now, at this point, approximately half of you, I would guess, from earlier lectures, from earlier repetitions of this lecture, have already thought of the twin paradox, and so I must dispense with it at this point. The twin paradox is this. I seem to have painted myself into a corner with, number one, relativity, insisting that there is nothing but relative velocity, and there is no such thing as absolute velocity, and then, number two, by telling you the time dilation happens as seen on the moving object as measured by the stationary observer, that is, the observer who considers himself or herself stationary. Because each of the observers, you say, considers himself or herself stationary. And so the way this is usually expressed is we have two astronauts who are twins. They're exactly the same age, Joe and Mo. Joe stays home on the Earth. Moe gets into a spaceship and goes at a speed very close to that of light from here to Alpha Centauri and back in a length of time which, as measured in Joe's time frame of reference, is only 1 second. And he gets back to the Earth, and lo and behold, the person who was his twin and started out the same age as he is 9 years older. But that's the way Joe sees it. He's the one who stays behind. From Moe's point of view, he got into a rocket ship. The Earth receded from him at a speed very close to that of light and then turned around and came back. He hadn't moved at all, and so how come he isn't the one that's older and the one who stayed on the Earth is the one that is the one that has not changed, the one that has not aged? Okay? The reason that that seeming paradox operates is that I haven't told you everything. I have cheerfully assumed that our astronaut gets up to a speed very close to that of light without bothering to tell you how he did it. But if he started out on the Earth, and remember we expressed this so that he did, he started out in synchronism with his twin and then got up to a speed very close to that of light, he has to have undergone the process of acceleration. When he got to Alpha Centauri, I don't care if he accelerated or not, maybe he just swung around at nearly the speed of light and came back to the Earth, but when he got back to the Earth again, he underwent the process of deceleration. And it turns out, experimentally, that although velocity, straight line motion at a constant speed in a constant direction, is relative, acceleration is not relative, it is absolute. And so they are not symmetrical. I'll explain that a little bit more in a moment. They are not symmetrical. They have not undergone identical experiences. One of them has undergone acceleration and deceleration, and the other has not. And it turns out, when you apply the formulae to the case of acceleration and deceleration, that indeed the paradox goes away, and the one who was in the rocket ship is much younger than the other one when he comes back. And that's the point where I have to ask you to take my word for it, because that will get into some fairly complicated mathematics. But when you apply those mathematics, it turns out that you remove the symmetry, and the way that you remove the symmetry, the reason that there is no symmetry, is that one is accelerated and one is not. Now, what do I mean by this statement? Velocity is not absolute, but acceleration is. What I mean is that there is no experiment, measurement, or observation which you could perform, even in principle, given any instruments that now exist or may exist in the future, any precision that you care to mention, that could tell you if you were locked into a windowless room, so you can't see the outside universe, whether that room is at rest or is moving, and if it is moving, moving with any particular speed. Let's take a simple example. You take a ball and you drop it. If you are at rest, of course you expect the ball to fall directly down and hit the floor. If you are moving, whatever that means, let's suppose that it means you're moving past me and I have X-ray vision and so I can see you even though you can't see outside the room. I say, okay, you're moving along at some very high speed. Just so it's a constant speed, it doesn't matter how much it is. The ball, as you drop it, is also. And so as you drop the ball, it doesn't fall in a straight line. It falls at a slanted line, which is determined by the velocity that you give it, plus the speed of the room moving in the opposite, moving in the perpendicular direction. But the room is also moving along at that speed. And so by the time the ball falls along its slanted trajectory and hits the floor has moved along just enough to meet it, and so it still hits the ground at your feet. Okay? You inside the room cannot tell the difference between those two situations. So there is no way that you can tell whether you are moving or not. Indeed, it is meaningless to say, I am moving, unless you specify the object you're moving relative to. That is really ironic, because only a few centuries ago in the history of astronomy, we went through this big thing about whether the Earth was really moving or the Sun was really moving, and whether the planets were really moving around the Sun or the Earth. And in fact, the answer is, it turns out, it doesn't matter. Either statement is equally valid. What Copernicus really proved is not that the sun is actually stationary and the earth is actually moving. What he proved is the descriptions of planetary motion turn out to be an awful lot easier if you make the assumption that the sun is stationary and the earth is moving around it. In the same way as if you are in a train moving with respect to the landscape, you generally consider yourself in everyday life as being the moving one and the people on the ground and the landscape as being stationary. If you were willing to accept the complications that would arise out of insisting that at all times you are stationary and that the rest of the world is moving with respect to you, and that when you get into a train, the effect of the engineer putting his foot on the throttle, or however they start up an engine, is for some mysterious reason to make the earth start moving backwards with respect to you. If you're willing to accept the complications involved that, including the extreme sociological difficulty of getting everybody else in the world to agree that you are always stationary and that they are moving with respect to you at all times, if you are willing to accept that, there is nothing wrong with the statement. There is nothing that is physically incorrect about your stating that you are stationary and they're moving, or the other way around. Likewise, if you are willing to accept the complication of having planetary orbital motions with respect to the Earth, in which the Earth is like this, and the sun is moving around the Earth in a circle like so, of course, that's just as simple as the other way around, and then the planet is moving in some sort of path like this, with curlicues centered on the motion of the sun. That's a horribly complicated kind of shape. It is very difficult to treat mathematically, but if you are willing to accept those mathematical difficulties, there is nothing whatsoever wrong with taking the Earth as being stationary at all times. What Copernicus showed, though, is people is a heck of a lot easier and gives you much simpler curves and much easier mathematics to treat orbital motion if you use the sun as your reference point and say, okay, the Earth is moving around the sun in a circle, or actually something very slightly different from a circle and a slightly eccentric ellipse, and the other planets are doing the same thing, and we measure the motions relative to the sun. But that's just easier. It isn't more valid. It isn't more correct. All right, that's true of velocity. That's true of uniform speed in a straight line, and in a restricted sense, it's true of these circular motions, and I don't want to get into that one. That's a whole can of worms in itself. There is acceleration involved in here, but it turns out that for what I'm saying, that fact doesn't matter. But let's go back to our observer in the rocket ship where it does matter. Acceleration is an absolute phenomenon. You can perform an experiment in a totally closed, windowless room where you have no way of seeing the outside universe and no way of seeing whether you are moving with respect to something else, and if so, with what kind of motion, you can still perform an experiment which will show you that you are accelerating or not. How do you do it? Easy. Same sort of thing we were talking about before. You drop a ball and see what happens. Let's suppose that you're not accelerating. You're way out in interstellar space somewhere, so we don't have to worry about gravitational effects, which of course will accelerate the ball themselves. And you drop a ball, and as anybody knows who's seen pictures taken inside Skylab, if you simply drop the ball carefully enough, it hangs there floating in midair. That's true whether you're moving at a steady speed or not. See, if you're moving at a steady speed and I can see you with my X-ray vision inside, you drop the ball and you claim it stays stationary, I claim you're moving past me at 10,000 miles an hour, however, the ball is also moving at 10,000 miles an hour, so relative to your hand, it isn't moving, and that is what you see inside the rocket ship. That's uniform motion. But if the rocket is accelerating, for example, because the rocket engine is firing, then what will happen is you drop the ball and it does not remain motionless in midair with respect to you. It moves more and more rapidly towards the rear wall of the cabin. What happens from my point of view is you're accelerating, you drop the ball, and it's moving at a speed of 10,000 miles an hour, but A second later, the rocket is moving at 11,000 miles an hour. The ball is still moving at 10, see? And so the rear wall of the cabin has moved towards the ball at a relative speed of 1,000 miles an hour. A second after that, the rear wall of the cabin is moving at 12,000 miles an hour, but the ball is still only moving at the speed at which you dropped it, 10,000. And so sooner or later, not the ball falls into the rear wall of the cabin, but the rear wall of the cabin comes up and smacks the ball from behind. In either case, the effect is the same. The ball hits the floor. And that is absolute acceleration determined without respect to an external universe. This is a very severe philosophical problem, the fact that that is true. It seems very hard to define the term acceleration without having an outside universe to measure it with respect to. Suppose there was nothing in the universe except you and the rocket ship and the ball. You drop the ball and you say, this ball is moving at a constant speed, so the rocket is accelerating up towards it. Accelerating with respect to what? There are no stars out there. There's nothing else. So how can you say that you are accelerating? How can you talk about motion? And yet, if you claim that acceleration does have to be measured with respect to an outside universe, it seems very strange that there is nothing in the definition or the formulae that describe acceleration which refers to the position of the stars out there, the distribution of matter in the universe around you. It doesn't seem to matter whether all the stars were on the same side of the universe, for example, or whether half of them are one side, half are the other side. How many there are, how much mass there is, how many, what distances there are, what the distribution of those distances may be. It doesn't seem to matter whether there's matter out there to measure acceleration with respect to, and if so, what its distribution is. And yet, it seems hard to understand what you mean by acceleration unless there's some matter out there. That is a severe philosophical problem, and they're still fighting over it, and I won't presume to give an answer. But what I can do as a scientist is say, don't worry about the abstruse philosophy, consider the results of experiment, and the results of experiment are, as I've told you, as I've just shown you by this very simple example, that velocity cannot be measured except relative to something else, but acceleration can be measured absolutely. And so once you realize that, it's easy to understand that the resolution of the twin paradox is simply that one astronaut has undergone acceleration and the other has not. Incidentally, it doesn't matter how severe the acceleration is or how long a period of time it takes place over. All that matters is you had to undergo acceleration, and that is the difference. And so if you have acceleration that is very rapid, for example, you go from essentially zero speed with respect to the Earth to practically the speed of light with respect to the Earth in 1 second, that's a very, very severe acceleration. Or if you take years and years to do it, it doesn't matter. Once you get moving at the speed very high compared to the speed of light, then there is indeed no difference between the situations of the two astronauts. Each claims the other's time has expanded. Each claims the other has gotten shorter. But during that acceleration period, there is a difference between them. And it's very easy to tell which one is accelerated and which one is not. Let's take the severe case, where we went from zero to almost beta equals one, almost the speed of light, in 1 second. The one who has undergone the acceleration is the one who has been flattened out into a thin film on the rear wall of the cabin. Okay, so it is very, very obvious which one is accelerated and which one is not. And in a more gentle case, where you're accelerating at, say, one gravity, one Earth gravity, then the one who has felt the sensation of weight, even though away from the gravitational field, is the one who has undergone acceleration. I'll mention parenthetically that although you can detect acceleration in a closed room without respect to the outside universe, you cannot tell the difference between a situation where you are accelerating uniformly and a situation where you're sitting on the surface of a planet and gravity is pulling the ball down at a greater and greater and greater speed, an accelerating speed. That's called the principle of equivalence. It's of no relevance to us in this lecture, which is devoted to special relativity, but it's a cornerstone of general relativity, and so I wanted to mention it. There's no way you can tell the difference between acceleration and gravity. They have exactly the same effects both there and in all other cases as well. But if you specify there's no gravity around, then you can measure acceleration in an absolute manner. I'd appreciate it. I'm sure you've noticed WKAR is taping us, and if you've been to the previous lectures, you'll have noticed they're being taped as well. The first one of those is going to be broadcast beginning on a day, coincidentally, that is the next lecture that I'm going to give here also. And so at 10 o'clock in the morning of December 8th, and that's right here on this schedule, and please grab a copy of this if you don't have one. There are two piles here, and there are piles over there by the door as well. 10 o'clock in the morning of December 8th, they'll begin broadcasting the first lecture that I gave in this series, which is on the space shuttle, and that will go on for an hour that day, and then an hour the following Thursday, and then an hour the Thursday after that, because that was a three-hour lecture counting the question and answer session. And then thereafter, dates still to be determined, right? Okay, but the first one of those will be on December 8th. So I think this is a very fine thing that WKAR is doing, recording these words for our posteriors, and the least you can do is everybody listen. Also, if any of you make it down to Ann Arbor, I do a series of lecture and film presentations there called the University of Michigan Astronomical Film Festival. The third program in the current series is tomorrow night. So if you have nothing better to do than to drive to Ann Arbor and listen to me once again tomorrow night, you can do so. It is in Auditorium 3 of the Modern Languages Building, which is easy to find on the U of M campus because you start out at the major intersection on campus, which is State running north-south and Huron running east-west. Then you go one block south and then one block east, and there is the Modern Languages Building, big brick and glass building, modernistic-looking thing. Program begins at 8 o'clock. We're going to play a portion of the Voyager recording, and that will begin at 7:40 p.m., 20 minutes to 8. And so if you'd like to hear that, be there at 20 minutes of 8 tomorrow. The program is about the Earth. It will include a film about Skylab, and then one in a continuing series of lectures that I'm giving called A Skylab Tour of the United States, Part 4. And in the MSU series, part one of that will be in the May program, as you'll see here on the schedule. Part four is understandable independently of parts one, two, and three, so you'd be able to get something out of it, whether you were there for the other ones or not. That's tomorrow night, and that's another whole series, and there will be schedules of those to be given out. The next program, the December one, happens to be exactly the same thing that I'm doing here the previous night. So it wouldn't be much point in you going down for that one unless you just had to hear it a second time. But most of them will in fact be different, although we'll probably cover all the lectures in both places eventually. Well, the least I can do is give you the next limerick, and that is perhaps the most famous one of them and has to do with the time dilation effect. You'll recall that as the speed of the moving object, and that always means moving with respect to you, got greater and greater, time intervals on that object, as you measure them, became longer and longer. Time seemed to stretch out. And so the way the limerick goes is, there was a young lady named Bright, whose speed was much greater than light. She set out one day in a relative way and returned on the previous night. Now, in fact, that is not what would happen. If you look at the formula, it does not imply that time would switch around and become negative if your speed becomes greater than light. It would become imaginary. That is to say, it would start involving the square root of minus one. So the limerick is not correct, unlike the one about the Fitzgerald contraction, the fencer named Fisk. But it's a fun limerick and it's famous, so I wanted to mention it. It is difficult to tell you the reason for the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction and time dilation, because it is difficult to tell you the reason for anything. As a matter of fact, it is more than difficult, it is impossible. I want you to know something about the nature of science, which this lecture happens to lend itself to particularly. You get into a lot of philosophy of science in any lecture on relativity, so it's a good place to introduce them. Something about the nature of science which scientists know, but which virtually nobody who isn't a scientist knows. And I think it is something that is very important and should be more widely known. This is the kind of thing that ought to be in elementary science courses and generally isn't. Science, the nature of science, is such that it cannot explain anything. It can only describe. Let me give you an example and you'll see what I mean. Suppose you take a ball, here's the surface of the Earth, and you drop it. You let go of it, and, as you know, it falls and hits the ground. You ask a physicist, why? The physicist says, gravity. That is not an answer to your question. That is not an explanation. Gravity is a name for the fact that the ball fell and hit the ground. It does not tell you in any sense why it hit the ground. It doesn't tell you things you didn't know before. Or does it? I'm being a little unfair. Gravity is a name not just for the fact that this ball happened to fall on this particular occasion and hit the ground, but a name for the fact that all objects that are left unsupported in midair near the surface of the Earth fall and hit the ground, with the exception of cases that we can explain our way out of, such as helium balloons. It is, in fact, beyond that, a name for the fact that the Earth attracts all objects in the universe towards it. It is beyond that a name for the fact that every object in the universe attracts every other object in the universe towards it, according to a law which can be written as a particular formula. That is, I'm just writing this for illustration, it's not a major part of the lecture, that the force of gravity exerted by an object of a particular mass, mass means almost the same as weight if you're not familiar with the term, on an object of another mass is equal to a particular constant, which is a number, which is always represented by G, it's 6.678 times 10 to the minus 8 if you're using the metric system, multiplied by the mass of the one object, multiplied by the mass of the other object, divided by the square of the distance between their centers. But it hasn't told you why that happens. It just tells you that it does. As you can prove by performing a very simple experiment, you wait until your physicist has gotten through writing this formula on the blackboard and explaining what it means, and then, please wait till he's finished, be polite, and then in your best childlike innocent manner, you look up at him with your baby blue eyes and you say, why does every object in the universe attract every other object with a force that is equal to the amount given by this formula? If you are very unlucky, your physicist may happen to be a specialist in gravitational theory, and so he will start lecturing you on interchange of virtual gravitons by the two masses, or on curvature of space-time in the vicinity of a mass. You don't even have to understand what the physicist is saying. You simply, please again, listen politely until he's finished, and then repeat the question, why? Why does every object in the universe warp the space-time in its vicinity? Or why do bodies interchange virtual gravitons with one another? And at this point, the physicist will throw up his hands and say, if he is honest, which few of them are, we don't know. And if he is dishonest, the questions you are asking are outside of the scope of physics, which is to say, we don't know. Because you can be darn sure that if we ever found out a reason, all of a sudden the scope of physics would be redefined to include it. And okay. I think you can see that that kind of chain of just asking why every time a deeper level of explanation is given can be repeated starting with any question, the question of the reason for any observed phenomenon, and always you will go through a series of greater and greater generalizations. This phenomenon is an example of this class of phenomena which are observed to behave this way, and they behave this way because they are examples of this larger class of phenomena which behave this way, and so forth. And always, when you ask, why does this larger class of phenomena behave this way, sooner or later, in about four or five steps usually, you get to a statement of the order of, we don't know, that's how the universe is, and we do not know why. And so, no explanation, no scientific explanation, so-called, is actually an explanation. What it really is a reassurance that the phenomenon you have observed is not unusual, that it fits into the category of similar phenomena which have been observed in the past to behave this way. And of course, you know perfectly well that in everyday life, when you ask somebody why and you get an answer of that sort, you feel satisfied with it. You know, in everyday life, the word why does not mean why, it means how. It means fit it into a category for me and reassure me that the phenomenon I have observed was to be expected. And that's all it means. We do not know the reason that the physical laws that are observed do in fact exist. Now, of course, there are people who claim to be able to tell you an answer to the question, why are the physical laws the way they are? Some of them are honest and admit they are theologians, and others prefer other designations, philosopher or whatever. They have two things in common. Number one, none of them is able to prove the claims that they make. And as far as a scientist is concerned, that removes them from any serious consideration. If, however, you are not bothered by that and you are prepared to accept their statements on faith or whatever, they have something else in common, which is they've got exactly the same problem as the scientists do, only one step further down. And so you go to a theologian and you say, why does every object in the universe warp the space-time in its vicinity, thereby causing the effect that we call gravity? And the theologian will say, because it is the will of God. And you say, why is it the will of God? At which point the theologian, if he is honest, will say, we don't know. And if he is dishonest, will say, the question you are asking is outside the scope of theology. You see? So it's exactly the same sort of thing, only one step further down. And so really, the question why does not mean why. It means fit it into a category. Now, let it be pointed out here that nevertheless, that is a very important question to ask because of an assumption that I've made so far in the last couple of minutes, implicitly, which I want to make explicit, and that is that phenomena do indeed fall into categories to which they can be assigned and which behave the same way. In other words, that phenomena proceed according to specific and identifiable physical laws. That is a very radical assumption, which we have made in the last few centuries with remarkably good results. We have, after all, landed on the moon as a result of it. And we have all of the technology which we see around us, which, whether you consider it good, evil, or indifferent, nevertheless represents a considerable control over nature. And that control is achievable only because indeed, phenomena do seem to fall into physical laws. I said it's an assumption, but of course it's an assumption that we try to verify by experiment, and the way you verify by experiment that physical laws exist is you first try to find a physical law, and then you check out lots and lots of cases, and of course at the beginning there's always a stage where you modify what you thought the law was, and after a while you get to the point where you got it right or you think so, and you find that indeed many, many cases in many different circumstances really do behave that way. That is a really remarkable fact. You are so immersed in a culture which takes for granted that that is a fact that I wonder if you have any conception of how recent and rare in human history that notion is. It is not a notion which most cultures throughout most of the long history of mankind have held. In fact, most of them have assumed just the opposite. I was first drawn to that realization by, of all things for an astronomer to be reading, the introduction to a translation of Beowulf, in which the translator, who wrote a very thought-provoking introduction in a number of respects, pointed out that it's very interesting. See, Beowulf's culture did not, Old English culture did not hold this assumption, and it's very interesting in this respect to observe Beowulf's behavior after, for example, he kills one of the monsters and see what he does and see what he does not do. What he does is offer thanks to God, go around bragging to everybody at the meat hall what a great hero he is, all this kind of stuff, but he does not make any kind of effort to sit down after it's all over and think over all the things that happened and all the things that he observed in an effort to try to understand better the behavior of this particular monster so that the next time he runs into one, he will be more likely to be able to cope with it. This is the sort of thing that you or I would take for granted to do. It does not occur to Beowulf because it does not occur to Beowulf that just because this particular thing happened to work on this particular monster, that the next one is going to be anything like that one. And therefore, if the next one isn't, obviously it's a waste of time to worry about what you did on this one. The next one comes along, and you can maximize your probability of being able to slay it by a number of things, by being as virtuous as possible, by trying to be on the right side of God. And beyond that, well, if it's the will of the, if it's the inscrutable and unknowable will of the Almighty that indeed you do this, then your hand will be guided and you will do it. And if it isn't, there's nothing you can do about it. And either way, it doesn't particularly matter what you know about the behavior of monsters. Now, of course, in practice, people tended to behave as though there were physical laws in some situations, you know.